You're listening to The College Connection from New England Public Radio. I'm Casey Gilman. The College Connection is a series of lectures from visiting and local speakers given and recorded at the five colleges. This forum provides an opportunity for listeners to engage with the researchers, intellectuals, poets, and authors active within our academic communities. New York Times columnist Ross Douthat visited Amherst College 1 week after the 2016 presidential election. He spoke about his reaction to the results of the election, gave his take on modern American conservatism, and provided his recommendations for what liberals and conservatives should learn from the rise of President-elect Donald Trump. His talk, entitled American Conservatism and Donald Trump, was recorded on November 16, 2016, in the Stern Auditorium at Amherst College.
Sadly, I'm afraid the only appropriate Dante quote for the chapter in American history that we've just entered is, "Abandon hope, all ye who enter here." It's a great pleasure to be here tonight at a very interesting moment in the history of our republic, excuse me. The Imperial Senate has not yet been dissolved. When I was invited to speak, I thought, like most people who cover politics for a living and who are alleged to know something about it, that I would be speaking to you all tonight in the aftermath of Donald Trump's crushing defeat. And that therefore this would be an opportune time to talk about the crisis in conservative politics that his rise exploited and laid bare, and the crisis that therefore awaits conservatism and the Republican Party after his defeat. Now, some of you may have noticed that he was not in fact defeated, and that most of the people who cover politics for a living were wrong, as I was wrong in expecting him to lose. And so it's actually a little strange now to have this as my theme, because in many ways what's been exposed over the last week or 2 weeks is the fact that the crisis that I was here to talk about tonight is much more general, that it is not merely conservatism that is in crisis, but liberalism as well. And so I thought tonight that I would deliver a version of the talk I was planning to deliver and sort of walk you through how I think the Republican Party ended up nominating Donald Trump and the sort of trends that led to it and sort of some of the questions facing the party in the age of Trump, and then finish up by making a couple of comments about what the fact that Trump actually won the election suggests and means for liberals and liberalism. And then we can open up into a Q&A in which we can talk about either subject, but certainly we can sort of dig into the liberal crisis a little bit more. So the best way to start out, though, is to, since we've sort of passed through a very lowbrow presidential campaign, perhaps the lowest of lowbrow presidential campaigns that anyone could have imagined, is to start a discussion of American conservatism at a sort of highbrow position, to talk about what American conservatism means if it's seen in the best light, if it's seen in the light in which its intellectuals would like it to be seen, and if it's seen in a light unlike the one cast by the Trump campaign and the Trump era. So what is American conservatism at its best, let's say? Well, the interesting thing about conservatism is that, of course, because it is theoretically dedicated to conserving, the nature of conservatism is going to vary dramatically with cultures, contexts, nations, times, eras, and so forth. And it's certainly going to vary from country to country. British conservatism is going to be a different beast than German conservatism, which is going to be different from Chinese conservatism, Russian conservatism, and so on. And American conservatism in a country that is rather younger than most of those other countries is going to be a more distinctive thing still. And I think a useful way to think about modern American conservatism, the conservatism of the conservative movement, the sort of alliances of different ideological groups that came together in the 1950s and 60s and sort of ultimately built up to the Reagan era and then have sort of come apart gradually since the presidency of George W. Bush, is to think of it as a defense of American exceptionalism in all its varied forms. And by American exceptionalism, I don't mean a sort of chest-thumping, rah-rah, America is the greatest country in the world perspective, though that obviously factors into conservative arguments occasionally. But rather, I mean that it's just a defense of things that are distinctive about American culture and American politics and American society that conservatives think are good things and worth preserving against what conservatives consider ill-advised efforts at reform. And so a few elements that I'll cite might be useful for thinking about this. So conservatives want to sort of conserve an America that is a commercial republic, a sort of dynamic, entrepreneurial, highly capitalist, even by the standards of the capitalist West society, something that's been true of American society going back to the colonial era. They want to conserve a society defined by a general suspicion of state power and centralized authority. Again, a common theme throughout American history. They want to defend an America that's defined by a kind of local communitarianism, a mix of civic engagement, religious practice, and participation that locates a lot of the energy of American life, a lot of the forces that bind people together at the local level in voluntary associations and so on. And this too, you know, you go back all the way to Alexis de Tocqueville in the 19th century. He comes to the U.S. from Europe, and he's startled by how communitarian and decentralized American life is and how big a role is played by local institutions, particularly local religious congregations, in a way that wasn't the case even then in Western Europe. So you have that communitarian element. And then finally, especially in the 20th century, but going back into the 19th century with Manifest Destiny, you have a vision of America as a kind of, I joked about the Trump empire, but as a kind of empire of liberty, a kind of Republican empire that first sort of, you know, spread liberty across the continent, obviously in the process of, you know, exterminating some of the peoples who are in its way, but this was sort of the national myth. And then in the 20th century, set out to, in the world wars and their aftermath, set out to maintain and preserve a kind of liberal world order. And again, with various corruption, support for authoritarian regimes, and so on. But this was a sort of central and distinctive fact about America in the 1950s, right? That it was maintaining a kind of imperial presence around the world in an effort to sustain liberal democratic institutions in Asia and Western Europe rather than for exploitation and pillage and so forth. So those different elements of American exceptionalism, I think, explain what we think of as the modern conservative coalition, which if you just sort of take it in its component parts can seem sort of self-contradictory or like constant marriages of convenience that of forces that don't necessarily fit that well together. So, for instance, you know, an Ayn Rand reading libertarian doesn't have that much philosophically in common with a, you know, conservative evangelical Christian. A, you know, sort of hawkish foreign policy figure might have less in common still with either of them and so on. But what unites these different groups is that they're each defending a certain aspect of, again, what they see as sort of America's exceptional status among Western advanced developed nations. The libertarian is defending America, the commercial republic. The religious conservative is defending America, this sort of extremely religious and communitarian society. The foreign policy hawk is defending America, the guarantor of the liberal order around the world, and so on. And they see themselves united in opposition to various forces that, you know, are defined as liberal or progressive or left-wing that, in the name of some higher justice, some cosmic justice, are seeking changes that conservatives think would undo what makes America exceptional. So to take sort of the most obvious example, conservatives fear that the encroachment of a too centralized state will both choke off America's capitalist entrepreneurial genius and will sort of take over and effectively bigfoot and eliminate a lot of the voluntaristic communitarian local institutions that have defined America going back to Tocqueville. That would be one example. You could multiply them. But so from an intellectual perspective, and again, seen in the best light and with some of the darker elements in the conservative vision set aside, that is what conservative intellectuals and conservative activists have thought of themselves as doing from the 1950s and 60s down to close to the present day. Now, the reality, though, of course, is that politics, the actual work of democratic politics, has a lot more going on than just these sort of big picture ideas and these sort of ideological visions of what America has been and should be. Most of American politics is interest-based. It's based on, you know, sort of people looking for their leaders, their governments, their politicians to solve immediate problems, whether those problems are economic, social, or otherwise. And when the modern conservative movement got its start, relatively few Americans bought into the overall vision that it was selling. In 1950s and early 1960s America, many Americans might have been willing to concede that in the course of building the New Deal and, you know, sort of establishing a stronger central government across the 1910s, 20s, 30s, and 40s, that Americans had sacrificed some of their liberty, you know, for the sake of protection from the state. But most Americans thought that that was a deal worth making, and that when conservatives warned about an overreaching central government, those warnings often fell on deaf ears. And so the sort of defining moment of the early conservative movement, Barry Goldwater's nomination in 1964, where you have sort of the first moment in modern American politics when a conservative, a real sort of ideological conservative, captures the nomination of a major party, ends with Goldwater losing in a landslide. And only really winning the states that he did win because his high-minded libertarianism ended up essentially making excuses for segregation in the Deep South. So that was not, you might say, an auspicious beginning to conservatism sort of translating itself from an intellectual project to a political project. But then, as they often do in history, events intervened. And from across the 60s and 1970s, the liberal order went into a period of crisis. It was a crisis of public order as crime rates rose and American cities became increasingly ungovernable. It was a social crisis sort of events associated with the sexual revolution, the broader social revolutions of the 60s and 70s seemed to be ushering in sky-high divorce rates, ever higher out-of-wedlock birth rates, and a general sense of family breakdown and social disorder that fed into anxieties about crime and lawlessness. It was an economic crisis, as the Keynesian policies of the 1940s and 1950s seemed not to be working in the face of new economic realities, and suddenly the American liberals found themselves presiding over a period of stagnation and inflation at the same time. And then there was a sense of foreign policy crisis, too, as the Vietnam era gave way to a period in the late 70s when American power in the world seemed to be at a low ebb, and the Soviet Union seemed to be on the march. So against that backdrop, in that environment, this sort of high-minded conservative vision suddenly connected to actual contemporary politics and contemporary concerns. And conservatism, instead of just having a sort of abstract defense of what America should be, found its way to an actual political program that many more people than the minority that voted for Barry Goldwater were willing to vote for. And this was basically the roots of the Reagan era and the roots of the period of conservative ascendancy across the 1980s and arguably through the 1990s into the 2000s. And it was a period, in many ways, of conservative success. If you look back from the vantage point of the year 2000, you would say, well, conservatives campaigned in those eras promising to sort of restore American supremacy, to make America great again in the world, if you will. And they succeeded. The Cold War ended, the Berlin Wall came down, and after the Reagan and George H.W. Bush's presidencies, America stood alone as the world's sole superpower. Conservatives campaigned on law and order and a promise to make American cities safe again, and across the 1990s, in part because of reforms launched by mayors and police chiefs with input from conservative intellectuals, crime rates fell in most American cities and continued falling into the 2000s. And then there was a sort of stabilization after the social crisis of the 70s and 80s, a kind of stabilization of American family life. Divorce rates came down, abortion rates came down, teen pregnancy rates began to come down. There was a sense in the 1990s that religion seemed to be on the upswing again. And obviously the sexual revolution hadn't been repealed, but there was a sense that America had found its way to a more sort of socially stable position in areas related to family life. And then finally, you had sort of two successive economic booms, the Reagan boom and then the Clinton boom, both of which were associated with the policies that nowadays people sometimes describe as neoliberalism. But basically with a sort of a shift towards a more free market approach to economic policy and a shift away from sort of state-directed economic policy in the 70s and 80s. So conservatives around, let's say, the election of George W. Bush could look back and say, well, you know, we came in this moment of crisis. We made a set of promises, at least some of those promises were fulfilled, and in the process, we have succeeded in our higher intellectual aim, which is to preserve a lot of these things about American life that we consider worth preserving. The problem is that, like many political movements that win a series of victories, conservatism then became a victim of its own success. It stopped having obvious reasons for people who weren't sort of ideologically committed to one of these specific causes to vote for its politicians. So, you know, you would vote for a Republican because you wanted to win the Cold War, but once the Cold War was won, that was rather less of an important voting issue. You would vote for Republican politicians who promised law and order when crime rates were high, but as crime rates came down, those issues became less salient. You would vote for Republicans who promised tax cuts when bracket creep and inflation seemed to be raising your tax bill every year, but after the 17th round of Republican-led tax cuts, suddenly tax cuts were a less appealing economic message. And you might vote for Republicans because you were a sort of person who felt like American society, the American family, was unraveling to a certain point. But once society seemed to be stabilizing in certain ways, you weren't interested in going all the way with religious conservatives on abortion or, you know, premarital sex or any other issue of that sort. So the Republican Party by the late 1990s and early 2000s no longer had a message that connected viscerally with a lot of voters who had been pulled into the Republican tent, especially middle and working class former Democrats, people, you know, the people who were described as Reagan Democrats in the 1980s, who had once been part of the New Deal coalition, once voted for Lyndon Johnson, ended up voting for Ronald Reagan, and so on. And the party didn't know exactly what to do about this problem. You know, these were voters who were suddenly concerned about wage stagnation and healthcare costs and issues where the Republican Party didn't have a lot to say, in part because the answers didn't necessarily fit with the party's vision of the America that it was preserving. You know, it's very hard to generate an effective healthcare plan if you're spending all of your time worried about the creeping encroachment of the state, because the healthcare sector is so entangled with the state that any healthcare plan is going to involve encroachments. So Republicans tried a couple solutions to this. The first attempt was George W. Bush's solution, which was basically to sort of move to the center on economic policy in certain ways, to move a little bit away from the sort of idealized libertarian vision of American society with a very limited government and so on, and to do things like pass a big education bill that increased education spending, to pass a big new prescription drugs benefit in Medicare, to spend more money on anti-poverty programs. Again, sort of working through churches and local organizations, but spending more money than Ronald Reagan would have necessarily liked, although Reagan spent plenty of money in his own way. And so that was sort of compassionate conservatism, right? That was the Bush pitch. And then that pitch was linked to 9/11, fear of terrorism, and Republicans felt like briefly that they had sort of recaptured, they'd recaptured sort of the Cold War moment where suddenly there was a new foreign policy issue where, you know, people would vote for them in order to keep America safe, basically. But unfortunately for Republicans and for the country, all of that came apart. The Iraq occupation was a disaster. There were no weapons of mass destruction. And then the sort of transient Bush economic boom turned out to be just a bubble that ended with a massive financial crisis. A crisis in which certain sort of compassionate conservatism policies, including the Bush administration's effort to increase homeownership rates by encouraging low down payment mortgages, turned out to have been one of the forces that led to the bubble forming in the first place. So this produced a backlash within conservatism, which we think of now as the Tea Party era, basically, where a lot of conservatives said, well, look, the Bush administration ended in disaster because we forgot about those ideals that we were supposed to be implementing. We forgot about limited government. We forgot about sort of, you know, we went abroad trying to nation build instead of being just a shining city on a hill or something. You know, there were sort of various arguments that were made. But basically, there was a kind of especially sort of limited government backlash against Bush-era compassionate conservatism, and that sort of defined the Tea Party moment in American politics, where there was a sense of saying no, absolutely no to compromise of any kind, no compromise on health care, you know, no raising the debt ceiling, no to compromise, we're just going to stand firm in conservative principle. And that worked out fairly well in midterm elections, especially the 2010 election when there was an unpopular healthcare bill to run against. It worked out much less well in the 2012 presidential election where you had, you know, Mitt Romney going around the country sort of appealing to the spirit of the heroic entrepreneur and telling people that, you know, Barack Obama's line about how you didn't build that was this terrible affront to small businessmen anywhere, everywhere. And most Americans, not being heroic entrepreneurs or small businessmen, listened to that message and thought, well, what's this guy saying? What's he offering me? You know, I don't like everything Obama did, but at least he seems connected to my economic struggles. And so the Republicans lost in 2012. And at that point, it seemed that the party was sort of stuck with a kind of perpetual conflict between an establishment that wanted to make deals and a base that wanted to sort of, you know, just invest and double down in conservative purity. And most of the battles that were fought in Congress over the last 4 years, you know, Ted Cruz against the Republican leadership, seemed to fit into that paradigm. But what that paradigm missed was that there was this large swath of Republican-leaning voters who basically didn't think the party had anything to say to them on their issues of most immediate concern. It didn't have anything to say to them, above all, on economic policy, but also it seemed intent on, you know, sort of betraying them on other issues. You know, that there was this huge push after the 2012 election to pass a big immigration bill that many Republican voters, not just conservatives, opposed, and the party pushed for it anyway, and it came to grief. So you had this constituency that was not incredibly ideologically conservative, was not incredibly moderate either, was sort of essentially looking for a champion who would come to them and say, I understand what your problems are, and I'm going to do something about it, and I don't care if the things I do aren't technically conservative. And that is a big part of the story of the rise of Donald Trump. Donald Trump basically ran a primary campaign in which he flew around the country to parts of the country that vote Republican but have suffered economically over the last 10 or 15 years, have lost jobs, lost population, stagnated, and so on, and held big rallies where he promised everyone that they would get their jobs back. And this turned out to be a very effective way of winning votes. He also spent a great deal of time basically smashing conservative orthodoxy after conservative orthodoxy. And if you watched For Your Sins, many of the Republican debates, you would see again and again, Trump would say something. He would say that he was going to protect Medicare and Social Security. He'd never cut them. That he was going to make sure everyone had health care, and it'll be the biggest, most amazing health care you've ever had. And someone, Ted Cruz, Marco Rubio, Rand Paul, would say, well, he's not a conservative. This was said over and over again during the primary campaign. And it was true. The premises of Trump's campaign were not really the premises that I started out with, sort of defining as sort of the high-minded vision of conservatism. Was Trump religious? No, not in the slightest. Did Trump care about sort of Tocquevillian community? Of course he didn't. Did Trump have a vision of sort of defending the post-World War II liberal order around the world? No. Trump was interested in going in, taking the oil, killing the terrorists, and making sure our NATO allies pay us tribute. You can go, and Trump was, yes, a sort of, he was a commercial figure in that sense. He was a businessman. He did fit in with that part of the conservative vision, but his vision of what commerce meant was basically sort of constant partnerships between business and government, which is, of course, the nature of the New York real estate developers' line of business. You know, Trump was no kind and remains no kind of principled economic libertarian, and nothing about his campaign suggested that he was particularly interested in being one. So the campaign he ran was in tension with all of the sort of theoretical visions of what conservatism is. But it didn't matter because it spoke to the issues on the ground, wage stagnation, job loss, disappointment with the effects of trade deals and globalization and so on, that conservative ideology wasn't successfully addressing. And it also wove in something sort of that had always been present as part of American conservatism, but as more of a minor theme, a kind of vision of America as not as sort of a propositional nation and not as sort of a constitutional republic founded on sort of high-minded Declaration of Independence ideals, but as a kind of ethno-state, as something much more European. And thus Trump's sort of implicit and explicit appeals to a kind of white identity politics, basically, that again is not part of sort of the pristine vision of what conservative politics is supposed to be, but, you know, had been present, percolating in the world of talk radio and Fox News, and Trump sort of brought it up and made it a major theme, and that too was an incredibly successful message. So basically, Trump ran a primary campaign against every element from constitutionalism to sort of religious conservatism and so on down the list of what high-minded conservative intellectuals and newspaper columnists like myself like to tell ourselves that we were defending in print and before audiences on college campuses. He ran against all of these things, and he found a large constituency within the conservative coalition that was very interested in what he had to say, and that constituency, for various contingent reasons related to the divisions within the Republican Party, elevated him to the nomination, which it was, you know, a sort of surprising and staggering thing. Now, when I outlined this talk, again, a few weeks ago, the way it went from here was basically I said, well, you know, obviously this ultimately failed. He didn't win the general election. So the question for conservatives is what lessons they should learn from it. And the argument that I was going to make was basically an argument that I've been making, including in that book that we all had a good laugh about, Grand New Party, going back about 10 years, which is that basically the future of conservatism depends on an ability to sort of make contact with political and economic reality and address the grievances and anxieties of middle and working class voters, particularly on economic issues, in a way that sort of preempts and forestalls and rechannels some of the darker and more toxic forces that would otherwise respond to and address those grievances. Basically, the idea being that, you know, you want a conservatism that can be more populist without being a vehicle for noxious white identity politics. You want a conservatism that can say, you know, as Trump says, that certain conservative economic dogmas are a little bit out of date and that certain Reagan-era economic policies may not be the right thing for the present moment, without going all the way to Mexican rapists, basically. And conservatism had an opportunity, repeated opportunities, to build this kind of this kind of politics, call it a kind of pan-ethnic nationalism, if you will, and missed all of those opportunities. And so then it got punished by Trump. And so the question, and it would be a hard question, again, in the hypothetical world where Donald Trump lost the election, the question is, can conservatism after Trump sort of learn lessons from Trumpism without being consumed by it, basically? Can conservatism look around and say, well, look, there were all these voters who felt that our ideology had lost contact with economic reality, and because we didn't speak to them, they went for this demagogue, this charlatan. But if we find a way to speak to them, then we can sort of rebuild our party around something that is populist but isn't sort of toxic and borderline racist. And that would have been a hard challenge for the party. And I have liberal friends who would argue that right-wing populism by definition ends up in white identity politics and so on. And that's, you know, a case that Trump's ascent made seem a little more plausible to me than it was before. But that challenge, unfortunately, is not the challenge that faces American conservatism, or not exactly. The challenge that faces American conservatism is much more confusing and depends in large part on the simply unknowable question of how Donald Trump is actually likely to govern. And a few of you at dinner and otherwise have heard me sort of give this spiel already, but essentially the best way to think about scenarios for Trumpism are to think about Trump as operating along two axes. One axis is ideological, and it runs from Trumpism over here to conventional Republicanism over there, right? So Trumpism is populist, it's mercantilist, it's skeptical of free trade, skeptical of mass immigration, it's perfectly fine with entitlement programs and big infrastructure projects. So it's more sort of, you know, in certain ways more centrist, interestingly, than a lot of Republican economic orthodoxy. It's certainly more populist and nationalist. And then you have sort of conventional Republican orthodoxy embodied by sort of the smartest embodiment being a figure like Paul Ryan, Speaker of the House. And you can imagine scenarios in which, because Trump doesn't know anything about how legislation works and doesn't have people around him who are ready to staff an administration, where essentially Republican orthodox, you know, he has campaigned as a populist, but he governs as just a very conventional right-wing Republican. We can call this the Mike Pence-Paul Ryan scenario. You can also, though, imagine a scenario where Trump, through the force of his personality, the fact that he's been more successful politically than any Republican politician since George W. Bush and various other reasons, succeeds in essentially pulling the actual legislative apparatus towards him and fights some battles with Paul Ryan and wins them and sort of actually succeeds in remaking the Republican Party as a kind of populist nationalist party with sort of limited government conservatism left as a rhetorical flourish that doesn't mean anything anymore. So that's one axis. Then the other axis is what you might call an axis that runs from authoritarianism to incompetence, basically. So Trump's, I don't think I need to make the case for him having an authoritarian temperament, authoritarian tendencies, and so on. And among my liberal and left-wing friends, I think the greatest post-election fear is that Trump will be a successful authoritarian, basically. Not necessarily a sort of true fascist dictator or anything like that, but someone who succeeds in using state power ruthlessly against his political enemies, against vulnerable minorities, against the press, and generally degrades and destroys sort of the institutions and fabric of the republic while centralizing power for himself. So somewhere between a Berlusconi and a Putin, but maybe closer to Putin. But at the other end of that axis, you have a world where Trump is just way too incompetent to be any kind of successful authoritarian. And while he does make attempts to target minorities and go after his political enemies and all of these things, the defining feature of the Trump era is a sort of lurch from one disaster to another in which we're crossing our fingers and hoping that we don't have a nuclear war. And to me, that is the bigger worry, and certainly the more immediate one as we watch Trump attempt to staff up his administration. But either way, as with the axis of ideology, you could imagine Trump falling somewhere, you know, in different places along that axis. And so what does this mean for conservatism? Well, it just means that how conservatism reacts to him is going to depend on where he ends up falling along both axes. You know, the more authoritarian he becomes, the more conservatism's future and its very soul depends on finding ways to oppose him through congressional action or, you know, sort of useless newspaper columns, as the case may be. So that's one potential challenge. But then if he's falling way more on the incompetent side of it, then conservatism's obligations and liberalism's obligations are, I think, somewhat unclear. I don't know exactly what the appropriate response to a totally incompetent president who still has 3 years left on his term should be. And then on the other axis, there I think it's my own view is sort of simpler. I think that conservatism, that sort of Paul Ryan conservatism at this end of the spectrum, needs to learn something from Trump's economic populism. And if it can't learn something, then it's going to ultimately lose to Trumpism no matter what. That even if it succeeds in temporarily making sure that Trump's first term just looks like Paul Ryan's favorite budgets, in the long run, the drift of public opinion within the Republican Party and in the country as a whole is going to push conservatism in a more populist and nationalist direction no matter what. And so the party and the people involved in it need to, in effect, get out in front of that and try and channel that tendency, or else you're going to end up with the Republican Party as a sort of American version of the National Front, whether the party likes it or not. So you need to adapt to the populist temperament in order to avoid being consumed by it. But again, it's not at all clear to me. People keep asking me, well, what does it mean now? What happens now? What's going to happen? And, you know, like most people, all of my predictions have been wrong, so I can't make any more predictions. All I can say is that conservatism needs to realize why Donald Trump was able to sort of take over its high-minded movement while attacking every high-minded principle it held dear, and it needs to learn something from that, no matter what exactly Trump does over the next 4 years, because otherwise, even if we survive this Trumpening, there will be many more Trumpenings to come. So that's conservatism. I suppose I could just pass from here to Q&A since we're about 40 minutes in. But I'll say something briefly about liberalism. So this is, the West is in a small L liberal crisis. Sort of forget sort of liberalism as sort of just, you know, something we associate with the left wing. Every country in Western Europe has its version of Donald Trump, or you'd be more accurate to argue that Donald Trump is America's version of the parties that they have all over Europe. And in Europe, and indeed worldwide, there is a general, I think, revolt against globalization. And this revolt has a economic component that is populist and is therefore somewhat compatible with some left-wing policy ideas, including those of Bernie Sanders. But it also has a very strong cultural component, a desire to preserve cultural identity in a landscape in which mass migration, the speed of global travel and communication, and other dramatic shifts seem to be undercutting the forms of common identity and common solidarity that French people, German people, Americans in the Rust Belt, and so on have taken for granted for most of their lives. And liberalism has not figured out a response to this shift, this trend. The liberalism of the Obama era is more left-wing in certain ways than the liberalism of the Clinton era. But both liberalisms sort of took it for granted that with the right economic fiddling, you could get to a point where most people in Western societies were happy to aspire to be lifted up into a sort of cosmopolitan, meritocratic, upper to upper middle class. And that this process could get you to a point where, you know, the sort of the various cultural collisions created by globalization and mass immigration could be managed successfully without crisis. And to that end, liberalism increasingly became and has become convinced that most of cultural conservatism, broadly defined, not just a sort of religious conservatism, not just a sort of pro-life sentiment, but a sort of broader preference for one's own culture, one's own existing traditions, and so on, doesn't really need to be engaged with, and in fact is that the sort of health and well-being of society depends on sidelining those impulses to whatever extent possible, and to making sure they don't find too much expression in the political process. And this has been true for going back a long way in Western Europe, where debates about mass immigration, for instance, have been sort of deliberately kept out of the center of the political conversation by the parties of both the center-left and the center-right. And it's true in different ways in the U.S. as well. And that approach, I mean, you know, the arc of history is long, and it may yet be vindicated after we've come through the disturbances of the present era. But a lot of developments over the last 10 years, from the impact of the Great Recession to the impact of Syria's civil war and the migration crisis it created, and so on down a longer list, have put an incredible amount of stress on Western societies and created a situation in which more and more people feel like they're, you know, they feel, I think, accurately, that their society's leaders, the intelligentsia, the leaders of government, and so on, essentially see themselves as thriving in a sort of cosmopolitan, multicultural society and are happy to see older traditions and older communities simply pass into history. And I think that, you know, something like Angela Merkel's decision to open Germany's borders to more than a million refugees last year sort of brought this anxiety to sort of its sharpest point yet, this sense that the people running Western societies simply, you know, they have a vision of the future in which the traditional sense of Englishness, the traditional sense of Germanness and so on doesn't necessarily have a place. And liberalism doesn't right now have an answer to that feeling, except to describe it as bigoted, racist, and so on. It doesn't mean all liberals are describing it that way, but that is sort of the default impulse right now, I think, of the liberal mind, and has been for some time. And so the crisis of liberalism, it seems to me, is a crisis of figuring out if and to what extent that deep-seated cultural anxiety can be effectively addressed and spoken to without betraying liberal ideals. And not being a liberal of that sort myself, I'm not sure I'm completely qualified to answer that question. Some of you probably have your own answers, but I think that is sort of not just Donald Trump, but everything that's happened in Western politics over the last 3 or 4 years has sort of posed that question to liberals in a new and pressing way. To what extent can anxiety over sweeping cultural, racial, religious, and demographic change be addressed through politics in order to essentially preempt the emergence of overt sort of right-wing nationalist parties? And to what extent can it not be addressed because, you know, it's a betrayal of cosmopolitan values to pander or cater in any way to those sorts of anxieties? That's the dilemma before liberals. It's a dilemma that Hillary Clinton didn't resolve. It's a dilemma that Angela Merkel didn't resolve. It's certainly a dilemma that David Cameron failed to resolve. And soon it may be a dilemma that the leaders of France failed to resolve in the next exciting installment in our series of unpredictable Western elections. So having posed it that way, I'll leave off. And let's have a conversation about whatever you would like to talk about in this exciting moment in our world. Thank you so much.
You mentioned the dilemma the liberals face in trying to address all those who supported Trump who have these fears of globalization, and I was wondering to what extent you think the conservatives face the flip side of that dilemma in kind of trying to take advantage of the constituency that supported Trump, to what extent do they sacrifice their ability to, I mean, never mind attract the votes of, but even effectively govern and be accepted by all those people, people of color, for example, who in this idea of make America great again, they weren't given a place in that history, in that America that so many of these people seem to think of as appealing, that so many Trump supporters, that appeals to so many of those Trump supporters. So if we're talking about American exceptionalism where they're trying to conserve this past America,
right,
which obviously had slavery, to what extent can the conservative Party take advantage of that rhetoric while also still trying to speak to this massively diverse America that we live in now?
I think it's incredibly difficult. I think that, you know, and this is, again, as I said in the talk, I have a lot of, you know, I've been sort of writing about the idea of a more populist Republican Party for a long time. And, a lot of my liberal friends and interlocutors will basically argue that that dilemma dooms right-wing populism, basically, that sort of right-wing populism is inherently associated with sort of ethnic reaction, and that what you've seen from Trump, similar to what you see in Europe, is sort of a necessary integral part of right-wing populism, that you need right-wing populism scapegoats up and down, basically, is the argument, that it has to scapegoat the elites, just like left-wing populism does, but it also needs, you know, if it's libertarian, it's the moochers and the 47% who aren't pulling their weight, and then if it's racialized, it's, you know, immigrants, black people, and so on. And I think that that's, you know, I mean, clearly, again, the lesson of Trumpism is that sort of actual existing conservatism has darker possibilities than I wanted to believe. That's certainly the case. Now, with that being said, I mean, this is where I think, you know, the reality is, though, that there are elements of populism, economic populism especially, that are more attractive to a lot of minority voters than the traditional Republican line on economics. Like, a sort of economic populism has more appeal to middle and working class African Americans and Hispanics than does sort of the sort of Wall Street Journal editorial pages vision of always be cutting taxes for the rich. And so in that sense, the paradox, the tension, whatever you want to say, is that for Republicans to do minority outreach, they probably need some of this populism on economic policy no matter what. So it's not a sort of either or. It's not that you can say, well, we'll just sort of push the populism aside and then we can get back to doing minority outreach. The populism is itself a more effective form of minority outreach than a lot of what Republicans were doing before. And, you know, the fact that, I mean, if you look across, if you look in Britain with Brexit, and if you look at Donald Trump's own performance, you know, in spite of the sort of white identity elements of Trumpism and the sort of little Englander nativist elements of Brexit, both of them attracted some minority support. Trump did better among African Americans than Romney did, marginally, but and the exit polls are a little dubious, and we're not, the exit polls showed him doing well with Hispanics too, doing better than Romney with Hispanics, but the best Hispanic pollsters are arguing that was wrong, so we'll have to wait a year for the American Community Survey to figure out who's right. But Trump almost certainly did better with Asians than Romney had done. And similarly with Brexit, you know, Brexit had much higher levels of minority support than you would think from just sort of that, you know, white backlash narrative. So I don't think it's fully proven that you couldn't have a conservative populism that defined the national community in terms that were ethnically inclusive and stressed a common national identity and a common national history, that, you know, without being consumed by Confederate nostalgia or just nostalgia for sort of the days before the civil rights movement. I admit that that is challenging to pull off. I think it would take a level of political skill and sort of rhetorical genius that recent Republican candidates haven't produced. But I think, you know, there's a story. I mean, you know, I don't think there's ever going to be a world where the Republican Party is winning 62% of the African American vote and 71% of the Hispanic vote. That's just not sort of the way our coalitions are ever likely to shake out. But I do think that there is a possible world, a more unlikely world than I thought a year ago, but still a possible world in which a kind of, you know, a kind of vision of a new melting pot, basically, of a sort of new common national identity becomes the way out of the demographic trap that conservatism finds itself in right now. And again, the fact that Trump's populism seemed to, for all his white identity appeals, maybe win him a few more minority votes than Romney won is at least suggestive of the path that I think the party should try to take. Because the basic alternative for Republicans is we keep exactly the same economic message, we purge the racists, we pass immigration reform, and the Hispanics vote for us. But that's, you know, that has the benefit of not being overtly racist, but it's as racially condescending as, you know, the idea that, well, we keep our agenda that most Hispanic voters don't like, but we pass this one thing because they like their cousins from Guatemala, and then they'll all magically vote for us. That's not a long-term plan for the Republican Party either. So anyway, short answer, yes, it's a big problem, but I remain marginally hopeful that there's a solution.
Thank you for coming. The Republican Party has been long known to have a hardline stance against the former Soviet Union and Russia. Given Donald Trump's relationship with Vladimir Putin, how could you see the Republican Party's foreign policy against Russia changing?
Again, this sort of is on that axis of Trumpism versus conservative ideology, right? The closer you get to Trumpism, the more the party's position towards Russia could change. You know, Trump clearly sees some common ground and common features between him and Vladimir Putin. And you could imagine, I think, pretty easily a world in which if Trump had his way, you would have some sort of, you know, Nixon to China kind of, you know, opening deal with the Russians premised around Trump basically giving up on the kind of democracy promotion in Russia's near abroad that every American administration has been doing since the 1990s. So that seems totally possible. But it's also quite possible, one, that when Trump actually staffs up his administration, it will be filled with people who've always been Russia hawks and that will sort of keep American policy in that groove. Or two, that you will have this sort of temporary detente, and, you know, we had a temporary detente with Russia under Obama and sort of under Bush, that then sort of ends with Putin deciding that, you know, now that he's gotten what he's needed out of the detente, he can basically roll Trump. So it's like, you know, they get together and they agree to cooperate against ISIS, and Trump agrees to lift sanctions and let Russia keep Crimea, and that's a fine basis for a couple years, and then Trump's unpopular at home and Putin says, all right, now's the time to squeeze the Baltics, right? So in that scenario, that's the scenario where I start to worry about Trump leading us into global thermonuclear war, to be honest, because I think he would not react well to being betrayed by someone he considered an ally. But at a deeper level, there's an interesting issue here, too, which is that right now, under Putin, Russia is a more natural enemy for the center-left than for the right in certain ways, just because Putin has sort of established himself as this, you know, almost vanguard figure for the global far right. He's sort of, you know, done things around gay rights and other issues that are sort of, you know, represent a particular affront to Western liberals. And so you could imagine a world in which there's still sort of center right Russia hawkery, but sort of the locus of anti-Russian feeling shifts to a center left that feels itself besieged by far rights all around the world and sees Putin as sort of the puppet master. And you saw the beginnings of this, I think, in certain ways in this campaign with Putin's interference where, you know, for obvious reasons, because he was interfering against Hillary, there was this sort of this level of Russia hawkishness on the center left that I had, you know, had not seen in my adult lifetime, basically.
Thank you so much for coming. I was wondering what role you felt media coverage played, how it played a role in the outcome of this election.
Played a big role. Starting with, and it started way back in the Republican primary, where the media decided, you know, I mean, Donald Trump was covered as no presidential candidate has ever been covered before. His rallies were broadcast at length. He dominated cable news. He crowded out every other Republican presidential candidate. And, you know, I would go on CNN during this time. You know, you'd go on one morning a week to talk about politics. And it was always, let's talk about what Donald Trump has said. And maybe in passing, we'll mention some other candidate. So he was treated basically as, you know, as a sort of, as a celebrity reality TV star, which of course he is, in a way that's unique, I think, in any presidential campaign. And while, you know, I have conservative friends who, you know, think there was like literally a sort of liberal media conspiracy to make Trump the nominee, there wasn't a literal conspiracy. But I do think a lot of people in the media who tend to lean more to the left thought this was all a big joke, basically, that it was sort of hilarious. I think the press had no idea. The press, one, was sort of in love with the experience, right? Like, and the ratings, you know, this sort of, it was, the Republican primary was a reality TV show, you know, and everyone on that stage was a character in the house. You know, you've got the guy who's not there to make friends and the wild child and the, you know, I mean, down the line, right? And the media loved it. But yes, I mean, I think the media was not prepared. I think the media was prepared for the idea of a sort of celebrity taking over the Republican Party and wasn't prepared for the idea that this could end with the celebrity actually being elected president of the United States. And I don't know what the necessary response is going forward, but I'm pretty sure this won't be the last time that sort of the celebrity industrial complex enters our politics. And yeah, I mean, I think the media has, you know, I mean, what, you know, Les Moonves, the president of CBS or something, said it's probably, he's had some line like, you know, this isn't great for America, but it's great for CBS. And I feel like when he said that, he, like most people, really meant this isn't great for the Republican Party, but it's great for CBS. And he didn't believe that it could end up where it's actually ended up. And yet it has. So.
Thank you.
Yep.
Would you all join me in thanking Mr. Douthat for being with us?
Thank you, guys.
That was Ross Douthat, recorded on November 16, 2016, in the Stern Auditorium at Amherst College. Douthat is a New York Times columnist, author of Bad Religion, How We Became a Nation of Heretics, and was formerly a senior editor and blogger at The Atlantic. Next week on The College Connection, American poet Gerald Stern, recorded at Smith College.
Sitting with his friend, he learned how shameful it was to have played the golden trombone and not the wooden flute, and to have blasted his own way into manhood that way, instead of making a soft sound with his mouth and fingers. But he was stubborn, and anyhow, he had thick lips, which stood him in good stead in one case, but not the other. And furthermore, his friends had died, 1, 2, 3, one after another, and he was left to his own devices, I would say his own instruments. He could have considered a harp, or in his case, a lyre, and found a tall stool to display his wares. I haven't forgotten that, for he wasn't finally restricted to one thing. Indeed, a mouth organ, if push came to shove, something he could almost swallow for the drama's sake. Think of him getting rid of spit and warming up behind the French horns. The French horns he hated beyond anything for their thin lips and their benevolent sounds.
You've been listening to The College Connection from New England Public Radio, a series of lectures from visiting and local speakers given and recorded at the five colleges. You can find more College Connection online at nepr.net. For New England Public Radio, I'm Casey Gilman.